SafetyFM.com with Jay Allen. Changing safety cultures, one broadcast and one podcast at a time.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Safety FM with Jay Allen. Well, I don't even know where to start with this one because this one truly is a doozy. Yeah, I'm not joking as I say this. I have the privilege today of sitting down with Sidney Decker. Oh, yes. He's going to go ahead and he's going to do one of his speeches that he did while we're at the Global Safety Innovation Summit in Wollongong, Australia. Now, listen, he had two separate presentations. I'm going to give you the second presentation and not the first one. But post-event, we're going to have a brief conversation about what exactly he did during the presentation. So you're going to want to stick around all the way to the end and take a listen to what Decker's thoughts were after this. That way you can take a listen to his presentation as if you were there in Australia with us. Sit back and relax and take a listen to this episode of Safety FM with Jay Allen with our special guest, Sidney Decker, here on Safety FM.
How good was that? Okay, so now we're going to have a man who kind of needs no introduction, really. But what Sidney has promised to do for us, I've seen him recently working in some smaller groups and being brilliant at, again, challenging the thinking and not shying away from it. And so we really do have to do that with some of these ideas. And so what he's promised us today is that he's going to talk through some of the key thinking behind what we need to be able to implement and how to implement it. And he says that we can hold him accountable to that. So some implementation, some ideas, and how can we make this real? And I shared with him that he's amongst friends here, and we're all trying to make this work. And we really are wanting to listen to you and hear what you have to say to help us. So thank you, Sidney.
So questions during are very welcome. So do send them as they come up, and Zoe will assess my interruptibility. At the time.
Yeah, the juicier the better.
No, I don't know. Drew, what makes a better question? I should have told this. There comes a time that I was told by an American colleague, you stop building your CV and you start building your eulogy. Only an American could come up with that, right? Yesterday, I made a vow to myself, to you, to exude compassion from the stage. I failed miserably. I failed abjectly. The advantage, perhaps, is that, and this was an exercise of self-reflection last night, the advantage, perhaps, for you, is that when you go back and try some of this stuff at home or in your own organizations, and if some of the leaders who were here yesterday find out what you're trying to do, they will not be shocked because it can always get worse, right? And I suppose this is the role that I do not shy away from, which is to push out the absolute limit of our ideas and then see more beyond that in a way that many people go, shit, that's light years ahead. I have no idea how to ever fill the space that you've just with your running ahead have created for us. Somebody needs to do that. Eric has always done that, and he's been Eric Holnagel, and he's one of my great examples, obviously, and colleagues, and I'll tell you about that. What I didn't tell you also yesterday was that on the very day last year that I received in my inbox my certificate that I had become a chaplain, I sent this proudly to my mom's WhatsApp account. And a few hours later, I got the dreaded phone call. She hadn't woken up. She may have known. I don't know. I don't know. I will never know. But I was going to tell you that. So there is a time for theatrics. There's a time for moral outrage, which I honestly feel with some of the idiotic things that actually impose extra hurt and suffering on people willingly. And I make no excuses for feeling and expressing moral outrage as I did yesterday. There's also a time for intellectual impatience. When it comes to me, I think it is always time for intellectual impatience. But when it comes to theatrics and moral outrage, they can be modulated away for a day whose purpose is not to celebrate that sort of thing. Today is that day. Today is a day to give you a grounding in the kinds of ways in which we can together make progress as a community that really cares about this stuff. And I'm incredibly grateful that Drew was able to lay out essentially the rules of the game as he did. Drew was my first hire after we founded the Safety Lab at Griffith Uni. And what a hire. An absolute success. Incredibly wonderful hire. Drew, as you might understand, is an unrelenting colleague when it comes to making claims that have more moral outrage behind them than evidence, for example, of which I can exude many. And so, Drew, thank you. You did me proud, and you did yourself proud, and did the lab proud, and you did science proud, my friend. So thank you. Now, let me take you back. 33 years, which is actually scary, but 33 years, 1991. I am a master student in Leiden, in the Netherlands, where Patrick Hudson, anybody ever heard Patrick Hudson? I will not editorialize that. Over a beer, maybe, but not now, because this is being recorded. Patrick, we love you. Patrick Hudson was my advisor, my thesis advisor. Patrick Hudson was very friendly with Uncle Jim, as he's known in the trade, right? And so Jim Reason up in Manchester. And in the year of my, the last year of my master's in experimental psych at Leiden, 1991, a sort of a triad of collaboration blossomed up between Patrick, Jim, and me. I was at Jim's house in Disley, outside of Manchester, and many times had meetings. And interestingly, it probably set me back. And let me explain. As you know, 1990 was the year of the appearance of Jim's first human error book. This was actually his first foray in this sort of thinking at all. He'd been doing things on motion sickness and other various things in psychology, but human error was new to him. Now, the 1990 book has, and it's published by Cambridge University Press, really difficult to get, you might have seen it, but it has in it the very first version of what would become the Swiss cheese model, which is not what it was called at the time, nor was it ever a model, by the way, in any scientific sense. It's a cartoon, right? But cartoons work well in certain communities. And so 1990, there was a lot of excitement about this idea. And yet, of course, as you know, this was not a new idea at all, right? This is very much Heinrichian thinking from the 1910s, 1920s. In which, in 1930s maybe, in which we think in terms of a sequence of events, and at the end of the sequence of events, we have an unsafe act by the person at the sharp end, a word he didn't even use. That was later. An unsafe act. Heinrich made that term up. Jim uncritically copied it and said, now I have my explanation for human error. Also in this book, Jim made the very clear distinction between violations and error and had, for him, reasonable psychological basis for that distinction. That set us back as well, quite a bit. But what set us back most, as Eric kept impatiently, speak of intellectual impatience, for those of you who've met Eric, impatiently pointed out to me in the decades hence, setting us back because of the zeroing in, onto the label human error. Because in 1989, a year before the publication of Jim's book, Human Error, the HRO crowd, the nascent HRO crowd, I don't even think they were calling themselves that at the time, and we were all involved in the semi-production of this, and we were corresponding with Todd Laporte and Gene Rochlin and Adam Over, and so we were in the kitchen as these things were cooked up. But these were a bunch of sociologists and physicists who had a chance to go out on an aircraft carrier. They went, well, there's a research opportunity, right? And so it was sort of action research, which ended up answering the very safety two question, which is, how in the hell can so much go well here? How is it possible that we do not kill more people? That was the question. That was the question that, in hindsight tellings of the story, they came with. That's nonsense. That's not how research goes, right? That's the question that congealed out of that encounter. They started looking for other fields, air traffic control, electrical grid, which in California turned out not to be so hot, by the way, but or very hot, but, you know, bushfire hot. To prove the point. But interestingly, understand the contrast. So here in 1989, we have the first time that safety is seen as the presence of capacities. They didn't use that language. That was all Hegelian language that Todd and I started adopting and running with, and that came later. But here they were. And then, boom, a year later, Uncle Jim stands up and says, human error, we need to deal with the human error problem, setting us back. Uncle Jim, bless his heart, but has always been seen as a fence sitter in the trade. Which side is it now, Jim? Where are you? And so my conversations with Patrick and Jim went on in 1991. And 1992, I got to Ohio State, the hotbed for a PhD, for a doctorate, the hotbed of human factors in aviation thinking. Right? This is where much of the work, together with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, of course, from 1943, congealed and became the first expressed science of human factors, making points that were then elided by saying human error. Because what did they show? What did 1943 show? Don't intervene in the behavior and tell people to try a little harder. Or, as Todd beautifully says, to care more. Right? I love that. Let's have a great safety campaign with posters telling you to care more. That'll make a great difference. No, said the human factors guys back in 1943. You want pilots not to screw this up? Intervene in the system. Remember the quote? My quote. You can't change behavior by changing behavior. That's a 1943 commitment. Human factors. You change behavior by changing the system within which people work. That's what you do. It is not new. And this is the confidence I want to give you today. That you're not just drinking superficial, sugary Kool-Aid. That's not what this is. You are not just gobbling down some bloody baby food. This is stuff that has been thought about, that has been written about, that has been published, that has lots of evidence base for it for many, many decades. So you have the assurance that when you start working with this, very much in the vein that Drew laid out, you're in very good company. You're in very good company. There's a glider manufacturer, and I fly some of their kit, in Germany, of course, whose motto is this. They've been around for a while, 20s, 30s. Zukunft durch Herkunft. Which, Christa, means, that's right, we have future because we have a past. And that goes for us, gang. That goes for you. This is not just, oh, I got Kool-Aid. Bugger a bunch of Kool-Aid. There is a history underneath this stuff. All right, so 1992. Uncle Jim, and Patrick have convinced me that the research proposal I shall take with me to Ohio State to get my doctorate on was to have the following title. Now, this is super embarrassing. This is toe-curlingly embarrassing. The industrial pathology of procedure violations. Cringeworthy, right? Very reason-esque. Resident pathogens, violations, let's put them together, right? Send Decker to the Woods boy, David Woods, up at Ohio State, and have him do a PhD for our greater glory and honor. Yeah, nah. As you delightfully say in this country, I love that. Yeah, nah. I have learned that nah, yeah, it's different, right? But it's... But this particularly comes from males in this country who are among the most articulate people in the world, particularly when it comes to emotive things and stuff. So, yeah. I love you to bits, and I love this country. It's the best in the world by a mile. So thank you for having me. We'll talk more about that, though, because... So, 4 years at Ohio State, and some really interesting things start happening as I'm there. 1993, naturalistic decision-making. Who's ever heard of naturalistic decision-making? Gary Klein, right? Exactly. Or recognition prime decision-making. 1993, that's when that stuff gets published, right? Then Gary, who's also in Ohio, just a little bit over, goes off on a commercial tangent and starts writing books about intuition and, right, and appealing to a much larger market. But the basic ideas... where how can we understand decision-making not as if it's an idealized version that we see in a laboratory or that we might have imagined on a piece of paper? We need to understand decision-making as it happens in the world against the background of uncertainty and time pressure and all kinds of other crap. That's the decision-making we need to understand. And Gary, in 1993, was the first to lay out the agenda for what that research would look like. It's carried part of what we do ever since. The DNA of that, the fingerprints of that sort of work are with us. 1994, the first publication of the Behind Human Error book, then published under the U.S. Air Force, but since then published as a book, Behind Human Error. I was in the lab where this was written, the kitchen in which these ideas were cooked up, where we were talking about hindsight bias, about counterfactual reasoning. And then I pop out of this in 96. With a fresh doctorate, and the Kali crash happens. This is a 757, flies into a mountain in Colombia. American Airlines out of Miami. Nick DeFuri and Donnie Williams driving the thing. They're dead. 165 people dead. I was pulled into the aftermath of this because of the expertise that I had purportedly built up. Help us understand the human factors of this. The conversations around that accident, as many conversations around accidents, filled me, Todd, what's the right word? Dread, repulsion. They could have, if only they had, all of these counterfactual statements, all of these claims that we are wiser. This would never have happened to me, right? And even when I make room for the psychological defense that inevitably gets imported into these situations, right, where people go, oh, no, this would have never happened to me. Well, if it did, you wouldn't dare to fly a bloody jet anymore, would it, right? So I understand that. But even given that, I started thinking, we have to be able to do better as a community. We have to be able to do better. And then it's 98. And I got a call from my wife. She's been in an accident. Almost full term with our first child. The child didn't make it. My wife did. The diagnosis in the hospital was made only after a postmortem. Ruptured liver of the baby. And suddenly, this is no longer about writing. This is no longer about thinking. This is my heart that's ripped out of my body. And the dissonance that one feels at a moment like that, where you go, how can I understand why it made sense for the doc not to pull out the baby earlier, clamp it off, and make her survive? On the one hand, and the researcher scientist in me screaming, no, you've just studied for many years. You have made lots of opportunity costs by being in university for 10 years. Make it worth your while. We have to push to understand why it made sense, because he did not come to work that day to kill a baby. He did not come to work today to diagnose too late. What he did made sense to him, given his knowledge, his goals, his focus, his background. A year later, we're blessed with another pregnancy. Jonathan is born. We're in Sweden. I moved to Linköping because the postdoc in England was tedious. And they had just crashed a couple of fighter jets and needed desperate help with the human factors of all of this. So I'm in Linköping with my young family. What you do in Sweden is you get a lot of parental leave. A lot of parental leave, like 450 days per kid or something, right? And so, seriously, I mean, and then you have to split at least a portion of this between the two parents, right? Which, not necessarily man and wife, by the way, right? So, between the two parents. So, I have a lot of parental leave, and I sit there with this baby, which is batshit boring. And so, my intellectual impatience took the better of me, and I wrote the book, The First Field Guide to Understanding. No, The Field Guide to Human Error Investigation, the little black and red book, which Todd has been going around the world trying to find copies of, which is hugely sweet. And so, thank you. And he encouraged me yesterday to think about republishing it as an anniversary publication. It was a book that Todd told me last night that changed his life. And not just Todd's. Pup would tell you the same thing. And lots of others have. It was, Todd, what were the words that you used? It was
pure in voice.
Pure in voice. With a cadence that is easy to follow, that runs through the arguments, that is not tainted by any political or commercial interests or I need a job kind of thing. No. This was from the pure in voice, the original field guide. That field guide, some decade later, became hope, turned into the principles of human and organizational performance in a way packaged that I would never have been able to muster the patience for. But I love you for it, brother. And so thank you for doing that. My commitment in it was we have to be able to do better. We should be able to do an investigation and think about why it made sense for other people to do what they do and just recognize my immediate history, right? I'm probably talking to myself as much as to anyone. We have to say, let's not do counterfactuals. If only you had, then... Because literally, it's counter the facts. It explains absolutely diddly squat about the facts that happened. That's what we need to explain. They're judgmental. Because you could have. Why didn't you? You must be deficient in some important way. Right? And so we're judgmental. We're proximal. We focus on the, thanks, Uncle Jim, the unsafe act at the moment and the point of risk, where the final safety critical action flows through the hands of the practitioner at the front end of it all. Which is so unfair, because there's a whole expertise and error-producing system behind them. Training, education, tools, resources, time, shift lengths, all of these things collect
to create the moment of truth where it will be error or expertise. But as we already heard yesterday, the difference between those two is hair thin. And as Abraham Lincoln once said, only outcome can tell them apart. Think about that. What goes into producing an error is exactly the same as what goes into producing expertise. It's only outcome.
This is the Jay Allen Show.
Embrace a daily boost of nature with Field of Greens. Discover the simple power of one scoop to elevate your well-being. Enjoy the flavor that appeals to you the most and let the blend of organic fruits and vegetables enhance your life. Experience the following benefits with Field of Greens. Noticeable energy increase to power you throughout the day.
Improved quality of sleep.
Enhanced digestive comfort and a general uplift in your wellness. Field of Greens stands out with the selection of organically grown ingredients, each carefully picked for its benefits to your heart and overall health. We are confident that you'll appreciate the benefits of Field of Greens. If it doesn't meet your expectations, we offer a straightforward money-back guarantee. Jumpstart your health journey with a special offer, 15% off your first purchase plus complimentary expedited shipping. Just visit fieldofgreens.com and use the code SAFETYFM to redeem your discount. That's SAFETYFM at fieldofgreens.com. Experience nature's touch at fieldofgreens.com/SAFETYFM. And don't forget to tell them that Jay Allen sent you.
And we are back on the Jay Allen Show on Safety FM.
That's not a good starting point for an investigation. So I drew the Decker pipe, right? And at Los Alamos, it became the lore that we need to get into the pipe, right? Try to understand why it made sense for people to do what they did and put ourselves in their shoes. My inspiration for this was historian Barbara Tuchman. Right? And so always think eclectically and outside the box. History, yeah, history, yes. She said, you need to put yourself in the shoes of the person who was there if you want to understand their perspective. Remember taught yesterday, right? Change your perspective in the pipe. So that was the field guide. Now, I'll let others say what it did for them, but Eric then joined in Linköping as a professor, and we had good times together, Eric Holnagel. He had been at Halden in Norway for a while, but then joined in Linköping. This is the time when books come out like, and Eric has always loved funky acronyms for titles, right? The one that he was working on when we were sitting next to each other was CREAM. Told help me, cognitive reliability and error analysis method or something like that? Yeah. You go CREAM, what the hell, right? But you probably do know ETO. What does it stand for? Shout it out. The efficiency thoroughness trade-off, right? And he turns these acronyms into book titles, which, you know, the publisher loves. And so ETO. These things were produced while in Linköping in Sweden. Every winter, my wife and I look at each other and go, let's move south. Which, you know, you have to flip, right? This is the northern hemisphere, obviously, right? So, I mean, don't move south here because you end up in New Zealand, which is northern Antarctica, by the way, right? So, I love you, brother. It's, yeah, it's good. He's in the splash zone, right, Tulsa? have you fixed your vowels yet? You had a whole night. Oh my word! I should say this is not my native language. No, you can keep making notes, or you know, it's becoming offensive now, so I'll stop making notes. Right? So I'm making it all up. Right? This is not my native tongue, as you know. So so we're in Linköping in 90. I forget, but I was 34, and I was made full professor. I'd been productive, which you have to be. Right? There's basically three KPIs to become a professor. Drew, bring in the cash, get out the students, get out the paperwork, as in the publications, right? Three KPIs. Get cash in, students, and publications out. That's
all you need to do, right? Well, and, you know, don't. Anyway, there's some ethical things that you might want to do. So 34, full professor. And do you know, and this is, you know, a couple kids later, that the existential crisis hit me like the blast of a jet engine. As in, I'm 34. What do I do now? So I learned to fly big jets. I joined an airline to drive their 737. New generation. I wouldn't touch the MAX if I could avoid it. nor should you. At least sit toward the front, where there's no door plugs, okay? So Todd might be going there. We suggested yesterday that he take 4 bolts with him. Just as a peace offering, you know? I'm going to tell you, you're screwed up and how to fix it, and here's a good start, you know? So, counting on you, brother.
Yeah.
So I flew for an airline, which gets boring, too, by the way. I always started. This is what it taught me, though. I mean, it taught me many things. One is that you are the first to arrive at the scene of the accident. All right. Which actually focuses the mind around the ethical nature of the stuff that we're doing. Right. This is not academic. No, this is real. All right. And so, yeah, I'd been flying since I was 14. I could fly before I could drive, right? Like many pilots, but not yet big jets. So this was beautiful. It was based out of Copenhagen, flew to North Africa, Mediterranean, all kinds of wacky banana countries that, you know, have very little support or infrastructure, or, you know, you land with a jet and you go, a ladder would be nice, you know, and mañana. I still remember the contrast. I've been hit in cockpits, right, because of my inventive spirit. But as Einstein said, right, imagination is more important than intellect. All right, so I think I have some of it, right? And so imagination. I go, there must be a better way to start the CFM56 engine. Woof! No, there isn't. Down with the arm decker. I go, but I'm a professor. I get paid to think.
Not here, you're not.
And so, thank you. Stop thinking, start flying the damn jet. So we did. But then you come to Kos, a little rocky outcropping in the Mediterranean, which sits incredibly awkwardly poised above the sea level, about 400 feet above the sea level. And the edge of the runway, of course, Pup, is right. So Todd gets really bored with these discussions, by the way. Right on the edge of the rock, right? And of course, the runway isn't flat, it's sloped. And so it's an interesting approach. And there's no help from the Greeks whatsoever in terms of sending out some electronic signals to tell you where you are, so they know. You can see island, yes? And so, it's Evharisto, we get about family, right? And so, that's too Slav, I think. But so, I wasn't going to do that, sorry. Sorry, there's lots of Greeks in Australia. So I love you. Timofilo, right? So then the boss says to me, but you just count out the rocky outcroppings because there's other little ones just standing out for the runway, right? And then by the time, which, you know, you click it off, don't fly autopilot, right? So we clicked it off 14,000 feet down in. And so 3 islands out, 3 little rocky outcroppings out. Be around 1,500 feet, flaps 2, maybe 3 if you want to, right? And then you just, that's pretty much where you want to be. And so that Fingerspitzengefühl, that idea that you're actually an expert making things happen, that without people, that landing would go really badly, right? Without the expertise and the adaptive capacity in a cockpit, that would go really bad. And so all of these things it taught me. It also taught me that a lot of it happens at night and, you know, you can't look out. It gets very boring. It's like sitting inside of a vacuum cleaner, basically. 85 decibels in that cockpit and not healthy. So at least you get like 15 times more the air than you lot get, right? So because of the instrument cooling, so you don't get colds as often. They kept going bankrupt, and at some point, I got a request from Griffith. Do you want to come and lead a big research center? That was a bad idea.
I lampooned managers yesterday, and it's probably out of envy. Not that I'm envious of your daily hubbub, because I'm not. I can't begin to imagine how tedious that would be. But I'm envious of the capacities that you have to actually manage. So this is a huge research center. I lasted a year. I said, I hate my job. The university said, that's right, we want to keep you as a professor. You name it, and you get a chair wherever you want. I'd been in engineering for basically all of my career, which at some point the steely emptiness of it did not answer to the questions that I had. And so I said, let's do social science, humanities. Wild. That's where we founded the Safety Science Innovation Lab, recruited Drew, and the rest is history, except it isn't. Because we founded the lab in 2012. And we're still talking about the basis on which you stand, right? This is not Kool-Aid drinking. There is a significant history beneath all of this. 2012 is a really important year in the shift of thinking. Two things happen. One is that Eric gives a talk in Germany. And the talk is called Why Work as Imagined is Not Work as Done. To some really vague, specialized German uber nerd audience, right? And that talk forms the basis. Blue line, black line. It forms the basis for our commitment to understand how normal work is done. It forms the basis for operational learning. It forms the basis for getting in and understanding what people actually do when nothing has gone wrong. And so we're slowly extricating ourselves from this 20-year-old reason-esque morass of trying to manage human error. Forget a bunch of managing human error. We need to understand how people get stuff done and help them do it better. That has always been Eric's impatient commitment, and it became ours. This is when Safety Differently as a label was born. 2 years, may I just point this out. Ahead of Safety 1 versus Safety 2. Eric and I love having this discussion, right? I was first. No, I was first, right? But in science, you're either first or you're not first. Right? So it's a dog-eat-dog. It's a dog-eat-dog world, yeah. but it can get vicious, right? Really vicious because the stakes are so low. Except, damn it, they aren't. Because look at you. Would you be here? Would you be here if we didn't have these ideas in 2012? If that talk hadn't been given? We didn't come up with Safety 2, Safety Differently? You'd probably be ICAMing your way through to retirement or something, right? Which is a vision of hell, okay? So, it's now a verb. I can. so, we, very interestingly, the commitments made by the Safety Differently Thinking and the Safety Lab, as well as Safety 1 versus Safety 2, are almost perfectly overlapping, although Eric claims greater, I think, ideological purity than we do, because we sort of waddle into the management space and it becomes all a bit squishy, whereas Eric stays on the straight and narrow of the ideological argument. The ideological argument being, once again, Uncle Jim, I hope you hear this, that safety is not the absence of errors and violations. It's, as Todd said yesterday, the presence of capacities that make things go well. 2012. Safety is not the absence of negatives. This is, of course, where zero becomes problematic, right? But agree with Drew, problematic in a theoretical or ideological sense, right? And even sort of a cybernetic sense, Drew. I mean, you could make the argument that committing to zero is sort of a fundamental regulator paradox, right, that cybernetics loves to talk about. A fundamental regulator paradox is if you get so good at running your system that the only data trace that you have is down to zero, what the hell are you going to run the system on? What data? What are you going to use to adjust the managing of your system, right? And that's the ridiculousness of zero as a fundamental regulator paradox. So safety as the presence of capacities. Now,
Sydney, you've got a question.
Go.
And it's relevant to what you just said. So the question is, beyond contradicting zero harm, what would be your next best suggestion for organisations to improve safety? What does improved safety really mean? Just a little one.
I think, this, of course, the answer depends. That's a Kool-Aid question, by the way, right? As in, I love your intellectual history, but I want Kool-Aid! Give it to me, right? It's a kind of question, and I love you for asking it, and thank you for your courage to ask it, and I'll probably kill that courage right now. It's a question that hands your brain to me on a silver platter, right? Going, would you please spit on it and hand it back? You have a brain for a reason! You're configured in a place with constraints and opportunities for a reason, and I am not there. So the most honest answer is, I have no idea. But we can work on this together. And yes, there are a bunch of ideas out there. How can we start measuring the presence of capacities? Right, Michael? How can we start measuring the presence of capacities? Talk to Michael. There's ways in which even lawyers are getting... No, that's wrong. I love you, brother. No, not getting behind it, but actually we're out front of this, right? And in fact led the pack, and we have to acknowledge that, right? Because they understand, too, that the way we're doing this is not good. So that's a long-winded answer to saying the answer is there, but it is a collaborative, imperfect production. All right? This is something that we are doing together, which is why we're here. This is not, again, about spooning in baby food and drinking Kool-Aid. This is about a co-development. If it were easy and that answer existed, I wouldn't be sitting here with my bony tushy. You would have a consultant standing in front of you selling you this stuff. Right? Snake's oil, which DuPont did for many years. Right? And it's nice to acknowledge, and as they are gradually and grudgingly, that hegemony, is that the word? DuPontian hegemony is eroding. But that doesn't mean that the answer to how we need to do it instead is clear and obvious. But keep asking questions. Keep asking questions. And there are directions already proposed. The resilience analysis grid, the DDIS. There's various ways in which we can start measuring capacities, all of them imperfect, all of them tenuous, but all of them better than not having something to start with, right? So we are co-developers. You are early adopters. Don't forget that. Right? More people are not talking about this stuff or listening to it than are. Is that even grammatically correct? So you are, just celebrate that for a moment, right? You are early adopters. Without you, none of this would even be possible or remotely meaningful. It'd be fun, right? Todd and I would go drink a lot of beers and have bike rides or something, right? But it wouldn't be meaningful. You make it real and meaningful. That's where the answer is. The answer is in our community together, right? So again, thank you, Drew, for giving that prelude to that answer.
I've got a couple more.
Yeah, that's fine. I have much more as well, but yeah, okay.
You can choose.
No, you go.
So what are your thoughts on the Swiss cheese model, in inverted commas, being used as an investigation model? If you don't like it, is there something you recommend instead?
If I don't like it, first of all, the first rule of science is you should not believe a word I say. Okay? So what I think is utterly irrelevant. What matters, thank you, Drew, is where the evidence points. Is it a bad idea? Shit, yeah. Absolutely. It's an incredibly bad idea. Stop doing ICAMs, you lazy, lazy mongrels. Stop doing ICAMs. ICAM is a beautiful tool to find blame and park it in the most vulnerable fissure in your organization. That's where it sits. That's what ICAM does. Is that what you want out of your investigations? No! So, yes, I have many answers to that. I have 4 minutes and 36 okay. seconds or something.
So in that time, do you want another question?
No, I... yeah, sure.
Okay, what role can you play in creating alignment between the battling camps?
I like that. Camps. This is very Australian. We're all battling.
Battling yeah. camps. A new / old view of safety that creates a real challenge for safety professionals.
I'll just pull a Netanyahu on that one. Final victory is within our grasp. All we need to do is attack Rafah, right? Is that not good? Okay, that's not good. I have no idea how to answer that. Drew, how would you answer that? Help! Okay, you don't have an answer either. Part of the answer is, of course, the weight of the evidence, right? And it's all, in some sense, about a paradigm shift. And this is the issue, right? I mean, the issue with paradigm shifts, as you know, I mean, the Kuhnian, right? Kuhn's book. Did you know that has sold better than the Bible? This is remarkable, right? Tom Kuhn, right? The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, okay? Never mind. So the Kuhnian commitment to this is obviously to understand this as not as a clash of old versus new, a clash of paradigms. The problem is, with the paradigm shift, that a lot of the evidence being generated is generated within the old paradigm and doesn't even speak to the new paradigm. And that evidence generated within the new paradigm has no language or receptors within the old paradigm. What are you on, huh? Right. So ultimately, I think, Michael, but we could talk about that. Perhaps outcome has to help us there and say, if you do this, then look at the outcomes at some point. Right. If you change these input variables, look at the outcomes. The outcomes is measured in people happy to work with you, people recommending their company that they work for to their children to work at, right? Like apparently BlueScope does, right? For better or for worse, I don't know. Perhaps because there's no other jobs in Wuhan, Hong Kong other than serving fried food or something. But sorry, I'm being... Next question.
Fair. Okay, last question.
The last question?
Mm. So please explain and develop the link between human factors and the modern hop movement.
I'll let Todd do that. But thank you for asking. Actually, and it's a fair question. Pup, your assignment, brother. All right, I love you. Thank you. So Pup, but really shortly, really, really, really briefly, it is this. If the commitment is for us to no longer see safety as the absence of negatives, right, but as the presence of capacities to make things go well, then we have to understand why things go well. We have to study why things go well. This is what Bob and others do in operational learning. Operational learning is about understanding not only why things go wrong sometimes, but how they go well and how to enhance the capacities that make it so. That's where the connections sit. That's where the connection is between understanding your interventions in the system, the error and expertise producing system, to make people to equip people with the capacities to make things go well. So remember the early human factors commitment? It's not that we have a fixed world, a fixed system, and all we need to do is have a behavioral safety intervention with these bloody deficient people, because that's the Krausian sort of, right, the BSD nonsense, right? And so stop doing that. Human factors says intervene in the system if you want to change the behavior that goes on inside of that system, all right? If you do that, you can enhance the capacities that make things go well. And as Eric deadpan, as he likes to do, obviously, says, if it goes well, it cannot go wrong at the same time. Right? So all we need to do is make sure it goes well. I'm sure there is a string theory universe in which both can be true at the same time, by the way. But that's not the one we hope to inhabit. Zoe, anything more? Or should I shut up? Are we done?
That's it. You're done.
Oh, my God. But I'm not done. I have so much more. Okay. You'll have to come to my classes. We do run, of course, I'm selling now, postgrad program in safety. And we are still open for applications for March. So hope to see you there.
Thank you, gang. Thank you, Sydney.
Sydney Decker, how are you, sir? I am very well, Jay. Thank you for asking.
I mean, you just came off the stage.
I did.
You have just given us two different presentations back to back. I will tell you, I've seen you a few times. This might have been the most relaxed I've seen you on the stage. I've never seen anybody sit on a table before.
It's a very professorial thing to do, to go sit on a table, right? I've been told by my students that this is the poise that they have appreciated most in their education with me, that no slides, but a free-roaming, not a free-roaming, because there's a structure to it, but if the ideas, laying them out and being open for questions and as people go along. The only other talk that, and teaching talk, Jay, I got to tell you this one, that I enjoyed even more than this one was in Brazil, where I had an opportunity at a university to give a class in this stuff. And the class had, it was a big square room, and it had green boards or black boards on every wall, all around, right? There's just a little opening for doors, but that was it, just blackboards everywhere. At the end of the hour, the entire room was full.
Oh.
So whereas I really like sitting on a desk, it's a very, as I said, a very professorial thing to do. There's one talk, Jay, that I got to talk to you about, which was just sort of a lecture more than a talk, which was so spontaneously inspiring and so giving me so much opportunity to express the imagination, and particularly the connections between ideas, which is one thing that we always look for if we talk about these things in safety. It was in Brazil, and it was at a university, a bunch of industry people, but also a whole bunch of students in the room. And this room, it was a square room, and I think it was flat, but pretty big. It had green boards, not blackboards, but you know, sort of the version of the green version of blackboards on every of the four walls, right? And not just a single little blackboard. No. The whole wall was the blackboard. And so at the end of the hour, every single wall was filled with ideas. I'd been going around, but actually only me writing, which was interesting, but I'd gone around and just graffitied every single piece of blackboard that there was, with drawing connections between ideas, and it was hugely fun, inspiring, and imaginative, and people having to turn around and they see, oh, we're at this wall now. Oh, hang on, no, that was in 1913. Okay, so we got to go back to that wall, right? And so sort of with time as an organizing principle, as it always is, but yeah, those were fun lectures. We did not have that opportunity today. But a quiet, calm, well, relatively speaking, exposition of the ideas while being immobilized on a desk, I think, was exactly the ticket.
No, so you took this approach today where you were opening to the audience. You had them drive the questions. They're really kind of directing you to an extent with some of the questions that were going on. Do you like this approach better than what you would do as, let's say, for the traditional speech?
Not better, different. I think there is something to the performative aspect of being the stage tiger and just holding the crowd in your hand. And
Had them guns blazing yesterday. That was for sure.
With guns blazing, exactly, and offending people and making them laugh all at the same time, and almost like stand up. Right? I love that, absolutely, and it energizes me in a way that I think is very obvious from what you see on the stage. However, my day job is as a full-time professor. And so that's not what you can sustain if you're a full-time professor. I mean, that's how you teach. You would die of a cardiac failure at the age of 38 or something, right? So nor does it contribute, I think, to the Socratic exchange of ideas and asking questions and problematizing, whereas the approach that I took today was very much oriented toward that, which, in a sense, Jay, what I was trying to do was raise the bar for the audience by saying, all right, this is not about drinking Kool-Aid, because there's actually a significant history of ideas and science underneath all this stuff. And it's a little bit more than Kool-Aid, right? This is not baby food. And so I was raising the bar relative to the questions that I was hoping to trigger, right? And it's unfair for me to raise that bar as high as I did. And it was obvious in the questions that we got, which were Kool-Aid and baby food questions. But I suppose that they helped me bring out the contrast between, yeah, we could give you baby food, consultant, snakes oil salesman answer, or say, okay, what would science do? What would science say, right? How do we attack this scientifically and actually produce the evidence and find even better questions to ask around this issue? So I have forgotten which question of yours I'm actually answering now, but perhaps I did.
No, you're good. But here's the thing. Do you think that Drew had set you up properly in regards to moving that forward? Because it kind of coincided. Drew,
it was beautiful. It was absolutely beautiful. And of course, Drew. So this is Drew Ray, my delightful colleague in the safety lab. And again, as I said, the first hire of the safety lab and a very successful one. Brain bigger than the room. Right. And himself intellectually impatient and, dare I say, surprisingly compassionate in a way. And so to the audience that he is speaking to and with, I think getting Drew, not getting Drew, because he did it himself and spontaneously, but having Drew lay out, as I said, basically the rules of the game, right? Okay, if lawyers tell us yesterday that, you know, scientific evidence is as good as legal evidence, what are the rules of the game for us to produce that evidence? How do we do this? What's the discussion that we need to have? What is the questions that we need to ask? So I agree. It was a brilliant setup, which I was not involved in making, actually.
It looked otherwise, but I really did enjoy it. So I appreciate you coming by.
The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the host and its guest and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the company. Examples of analysis discussed within this podcast are only examples. They should not be utilized in the real world as the only solution available, as they are based only on very limited and dated open source information. Assumptions made within this analysis are not reflective of the position of the company. No part of this podcast may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, mechanical, electronic, recording, or otherwise, without prior written permission of the creator of the podcast, Jay Allen.